puberty, we don't really know what initially triggers puberty. We know we expect puberty to start in females around age 8 and in males around age 9. For females, it's just, you know, a couple of years before they completely go through puberty. For males, it takes a little bit longer. In both males and females, it's an increase in androgens that actually starts puberty. And part of that increase in androgens occurs because the adrenal glands actually grow and begin to produce more androgens. And so that's actually where that start comes from, is from the adrenal gland. And then in male patients, they also make those androgens from the testes. Adrenarche just refers to the beginning of puberty. And gonadarche refers to the changes that you see in the ovaries and the testes. So first we have adrenarche, which is the early sexual development occurring around 8 in females and 9 in males. And then that's followed by changes in the gonads. And again, so the adrenal gland kind of being our initial gland, and the ovaries and the testes then being the gland that becomes more predominant. And that's why if you think about it in females, when do you see acne the very, very worst in females? In most females. It's around that very point when we start seeing the breasts really butt out. It's that 5th grade, 6th grade. It's very early. As they get into early high school or 8th grade, when they're sort of finishing puberty, it becomes less of a problem. And the reason for that is what happens first is that they grow this little extra spot on the adrenal gland that starts pumping out these androgens that the females never had before. And so they have these oils entering their skin that they haven't had in the past. So it kind of makes sense that we see that. Androgens being what's responsible for acne in males and females, males just have a lot more androgens than females have. And I'm not going back through that. Female puberty is accelerated growth followed by breast development, which we call phalarchy. Early onset of puberty, which we also call precocious puberty, is puberty in girls less than the age of 8 and in boys less than the age of 9.
What did you call it?
Precocious. P-R-E-C-O-C-I-O-U-S. Signs of precocious puberty. You know, I've seen some girls with precocious puberty, and one of the things I've seen them come in for when they were real little before anybody knew what was happening is they would come in for yeast infections and vaginal itching. And so I wonder if some of those changes were occurring, because the next thing that they say that they see is acne, oily skin, and pubic hair. And so you kind of wonder if some of those early changes are what's kind of causing the itching and the changes in pH to occur. But in the situations where I've seen it, I've actually seen that as something that presented before the condition was actually diagnosed. But according to your book, hair in the underarms, pubic hair, acne, oily skin, those are kind of our first signs of precocious puberty. We talked last week about leptin. I already covered that. We do know that we're seeing more and more female patients enter puberty at younger ages. When I was a kid, they kind of didn't think you should really start your period before age 12. Now, lots of females routinely start their period before age 12. We do know our population our weight's increasing a little bit. Our general, it's not just that in general our kids are getting fatter, although some of them are, but it's also that in general people are bigger, you know. An 8-pound baby's now an average baby, you know. It's a 7-pound baby's a little baby. Babies are getting bigger and bigger, people are getting bigger and bigger, and so some of that might be related to the increase in leptin levels and the earlier sexual development that we're seeing. There's lots of theories on it, though. Menarche is start of the menses, and menopause is what occurs at sensation of the menses and when the FSH is stabilized above 32, indicating that our patient is no longer ovulating. We talked last week about how at age 50 you might have only 3 eggs left, but you still do have potentially 3 eggs. And so our patients who might be at a point in their life where they definitely do not want any more children, they don't intend on having any more children, and they feel pretty safe and comfortable because maybe they've only had one period in the last year, we really still need to establish that patient is through menopause with those FSH levels, two random FSH levels. Without that, our patient could become pregnant later in life, and those pregnancies tend to have very negative outcomes. Our phases of the menstrual cycle, we talked about menstruation or the menses. That's a uterine phase, and that's day 1 to 5 of the menstrual cycle. And basically, we consider day 1 of the menstrual cycle to be the first day that the period starts. We think about the follicular and the proliferative phases. The follicular phase is an ovarian phase. And so the follicular phase actually starts there on day 1 of the menstrual cycle and subsides about day 14 of the menstrual cycle. The proliferative phase of the uterus starts about day 5 of the menstrual cycle, right? Because the first 5 days we have our menses. And it goes on till about day 14 of the menstrual cycle. Then our luteal secretory phases, the luteal being with the ovary and the secretory phase being with the uterus, those are both days 14 to 28 approximately. We did talk last week that some people have a little bit shorter cycle, some people have a longer cycle. It is more normal for a young person to have a longer cycle, a 35-day cycle. It's less normal for a young person to have a 21, 25, 22, because those young people that are having those really close cycles like that, they're at risk for conditions like endometriosis. Uterine overgrowth is what we need to be worried about. We also talked last week, if you remember, as a woman approaches menopause, it's actually a normal finding to see the periods progressively wander closer together and the cycle shorten. And one thing to keep in mind about that is if she's a natural family planning woman, she might accidentally family plan herself into a pregnancy because she doesn't realize she's ovulating at a slightly different time than she did before. There's also some evidence that there might be more than one ovulation as women get older per cycle. So those are all things to keep in mind in advising our women's health patients. And again, this repeats what I just said. This is a picture that, and again, this shows you here. See, this is your uterus, your endometrium. Days 1 through 5 is the menses, your proliferative phase. It ends right around day 14 here. And then the secretory phase, this is where proteins and glucose and fructose and other nutrients are being secreted here from the lining of the uterus or from the endometrium because it wants we need to nourish potentially a fertilized corpus luteum. And so right about here, about day 14, is when we ovulate and develop our corpus luteum. Things we talked about last week, this spike of progesterone at the very end of the cycle here, this is what actually keeps our patients from bleeding during this phase. Because you see, we have all this tissue. Remember we talked about the tissue as being grass, which I don't mean to disrespect the endometrium, but we've grown some grass here. And our, once it gets to a certain level, there's gonna be a tendency to wanna just contract that off the uterine wall. And so we need that there to be able to implant a corpus luteum very effectively. And so this spike of progesterone here at the end of the cycle is what holds the menses off until around day 28. So that's a very important thing. How is that information important? Well, let's say our patient's on birth control pills and they get into maybe the second week, early into the third week of their birth control pills, so they're still a week from when their periods start, and they start spotting. Then you know what that tells us is if that happens in a few cycles in succession, that maybe we need to do something to deal with this progesterone component of their pill. So we look at that as far as the action of the pill. And there's tables that tell you real easily kind of how you pick that out. Also, another issue are patients with infertility issues. Sometimes our patients with infertility issues that are cycling too frequently, they're actually cycling at the point that they would want to implant a corpus luteum. So maybe they have sort of a late cycle progesterone problem. So sometimes you'll see those patients actually treated with some progesterone to try to keep that endometrium going in there. Some women who have a history of multiple early pregnancy miscarriages, when we implant a corpus luteum here, the corpus luteum will then begin to help produce more progesterone along with the endometrial wall. And so then the progesterone level stays up. And so sometimes those women, they don't have the ability to do that. The progesterone drops, they shed the entire uterine wall. When we think about the male reproductive system, external genitalia, The testes are the essential organ of reproduction. It produces the gametes. It produces the sex hormones, androgens, testosterone. Males do not utilize their adrenal glands as far as for producing androgens as much as females do. Although initially in early puberty, males and females both start with the adrenal gland. They're suspended outside of the pelvic cavity, and the reason for that is that sperm needs to be about 2 degrees cooler than normal body temperature. And so the combination of the suspension and the way that they actually, the vascular flow, both are very cooling and help to keep that cooler. I've seen movies from back in the 80s where they make jokes about, you know, telling men that their infertility is due to the type of underwear that they wear. They don't make as many jokes about that anymore. It used to be funny a long time ago. Was that one, she's having a baby, or I don't know. It was the one where there was just Kevin Bacon and his wife in the whole movie. Am I the only one that saw it? Mm-hmm. It was a pretty good movie, but yeah, he's going through all the stress of finding out that there's really nothing wrong with his wife, but it's him. It's him that can't get his wife pregnant and all the stress and emotions that it's causing him. And part of it was they wanted him to switch his underwear type. And that this is what they were hinting at in the movie. Let me flip my page here. The epididymis, its job is to transport and store sperm. And the scrotum is the outer sac that helps suspend the testicles. And actually helps with the cooling of the sperm. The penis also has urinary functions. The urethra goes through the penis and reproductive functions. We look at the internal organs. We have the seminal vesicles. Their main job is to secrete fluid for the semen. And the fluid contains nutrients that gives the semen energy. So fructose and proteins. It also secretes prostaglandins. And prostaglandins actually make the cervix softer. So that helps to move the sperm through the cervix.
So Cervidel?
Uh-huh.
Like, does that have prostaglandins?
Cervidel is made out of, I believe, seaweed. And there's probably prostaglandins in that, but I'm not for sure. It's not my area of expertise. The prostate gland secretes alkaline fluid, which helps the sperm to live in more acidic environments. Because the female body is actually quite hostile to the sperm, starting with acids that attempt to destroy it. The bulb urethral glands, they release a pre-seminal fluid which decreases any acids that might already be in the urethra. So the three together, basically if you had to put it into just, you know, what do the three basically do? The three together are just, their job is to prepare the sperm for ejaculation. When we think about the male hormones, our primary hormone is testosterone, along with other androgens, but testosterone always makes up the greater amount of androgens that we see. What does testosterone do? Sexual differentiation, development of the urogenital system, nervous and skeletal tissue development. It affects our patient's sex drive and erectile function as well. We're doing some testosterone treatments now for erectile dysfunction. Anabolic effects of testosterone, because it is an anabolic steroid. Remember, in endocrine, we just learned about prednisone that is a catabolic steroid, breaks down. Testosterone is an anabolic steroid, and so it increases protein metabolism, it increases muscle growth, it increases production of red blood cells, and it affects fat distribution in the body. So some of our pathophysiology, and you guys do not have this slide, and I just listed things out here for you. Some of our pathophysiology that we can see, erectile dysfunction, affecting about 1.5 million men worldwide that we know of. It's becoming an increasing problem in the United States. There's two reasons that we see erectile dysfunction in our patients. We have organic erectile dysfunction, and that's due to something that's kind of going wrong in the body, like something vascular, something hormonal, something neurogenic. So any of our patients that have vascular disease, like carotid artery disease, coronary artery disease, peripheral artery disease, they're also really highly susceptible to have erectile dysfunction. Our patients with a history of MS, Parkinson's disease, or stroke, those would be neurogenic problems that would be closely associated with erectile dysfunction. And then our males that have a lower testosterone, which we call hypogonadism, males that are not producing enough testosterone, because testosterone is actually coming from the testes. And so if they don't have the level of testosterone that we should, we call that hypogonadism. Those patients we will treat with testosterone. The problem with testosterone treatment for our patients is that nobody can really decide what a normal free testosterone level is. So it's kind of something that we look at symptomatically, we look at the range, we kind of look at the history with the patient, but we don't have really good criteria for exactly who to treat hormonally and who not to treat. Then there are the psychogenic factors. There's also medications that fall under organic, lots of medications. Psychogenic factors, most common psychogenic factor leading to erectile dysfunction. Do you know what that is? What? It is depression. Depression is the most common psychogenic factor leading to erectile dysfunction. And unfortunately for our depressed patients, many of our therapies that we use for depression also lead to erectile dysfunction. So that makes things a little bit more difficult. What we tell our patients is, and I'm sure you guys have covered SSRIs in mental health class, what we tell our patients is that many times the erectile dysfunction side effects of the antidepressant go away over time. So if we can keep them on it, sometimes we'll lower the dose. The other option we have is sometimes we'll give them the medicine for 4 or 5 days in a row and we'll give them a little break on the medicine, and that seems to help. Sometimes some of the longer acting medicines like the Prozac that we can give once a week, sometimes that has less adverse effect on our patients. So there's things that we can work with. Drugs like Wellbutrin, which is an SNRI, actually can increase sex drive in our patients, but sometimes it's not as effective for treating depression, unfortunately. So sometimes there's adverse effects to that. If their main problem is anxiety, drugs like Buspar actually will work for that. So again, depression being our main problem, and unfortunately it's tough because patients who have actually appeared for treatment of depression tend to need the treatment of depression, and unfortunately if they're already having sexual dysfunction, it temporarily gets worse when they're first treated. Again, the other thing is, not that I'm teaching a mental health class, but your patients need to go to counseling. They need behavior modification, they need counseling. Remember that when your steroid levels are too high, your cortisol levels are too high, is because the stress in your life has exceeded your coping mechanisms. It's the same thing here. The stress in their life has exceeded their coping mechanisms. We need to help them with their coping mechanisms. The medication is not enough. Nobody wants to go. What we really need to push them, because if you really want your patient to get better, you really want people to be healthy, we really need them to do that. Other psychogenic factors, self-esteem, anxiety, and relationship issues being other reasons that we see erectile dysfunction. Priapism is where a person has an erection, and I put it right after erectile dysfunction because it's on the commercial, lasting more than 4 hours and does not improve with ejaculation. It becomes a painful thing, and it needs to be dealt with because the continued erection actually decreases blood flow to the rest of the penis. And so eventually they can end up with necrosis of the penis. So it's a very important thing that we deal with. Patients that can get it, it can be a side effect of certain medications. There can also be psychogenic issues with it. Spinal cord injury patients, this is a big problem. And so sometimes it's something that you have to deal with in the ICU with your spinal cord injury patient. Okay, let's see. Neoplasm of the penis, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Neoplasms of the penis, not terribly common. certainly have an association to HPV, also HIV infections, but there are other neoplasms of the penis that are not HPV related. We do have significantly less neoplasm of the penis in patients that are circumcised versus not that are circumcised. The majority of the penile cancers actually occur in the foreskin that would not be there. So, okay. The other thing is back in the old days, and you'll have to read this in your book, when they first saw some of the penile cancers, they saw an increase of it in people who were like chimney sweeps. And the thought was that with the extra foreskin and being the chimney sweeps, there was certain toxins that they were cleaning out of the chimney, and then they were getting put underneath the foreskin and not getting washed out and cleaned out, and that was actually contributing to it. So that was one of the earlier things, there was some science to it. That was one of the earlier things that they were able to actually use to predict penile cancer at that time. So we do see some penile cancers related to toxins. Inguinal hernia. This is where some of the bowel has actually went through the truncus or truncus vaginalis and ended up into the scrotum. And the thing is that the testes actually drop out of the abdomen. They grow inside of the peritoneum. And so some people will have some degree of patency between the fluid in the peritoneum and the fluid within the scrotum. And so depending on how much patency is there, tells us how much risk the patient actually has of having a hernia there. Same thing true with the hydrocele. Hydroceles is where we have too much fluid inside of the scrotum. And basically, the fluid from the peritoneum is just readily flowing into the scrotum, and so gravity is pulling it down in there. A hematocele is just a little bit different because there's blood actually in there. And so our causes are a little bit different with our hematocele. With a hematocele, we tend to think there's either been trauma to the testicles that has caused the hematocele to occur, or the person has a clotting problem. There's a vascular hematologic problem that's contributed to this occurring. Testicular torsion is a surgical emergency of the testicles. And I have some pictures which will wake you guys up in just a second. Once I get to the bottom of the info on this page, we're going to go to the pictures and things slow down for a second. Testicular torsion, testicular emergency generally happens in young males. We tend to think that there's a little bit of an error in how the testicles suspended within the scrotum that helps cause this to occur. There are certain infections that make it more likely. We see it most commonly in adolescent patients. We kind of have to rule out other things like an infection of the testicles, a hydrocele, that type of thing. Typically, these patients are in extreme severe pain. This is like vomiting pain. Abdominal pain, severe pain. Usually the pain's making their temperature go up, heart rate's up, blood pressure's up. They're horrifically in pain. Sometimes they'll transilluminate them and they can see that the cords are wrapped. But if they are not able to transilluminate and see, they can do an ultrasound of the testicles and they can actually see that the cords are wrapped. And so they'll go in and try to repair that immediately in those patients. If they don't get it repaired immediately, they may lose one or both of the testicles. Epididymitis or orchiditis. These are infections of either the epididymis or the testicles. So this is our male patients with untreated chlamydia or gonorrhea or some other bacterial infection.
So they have an infection of the epididymis?
They can.
The orchiditis is only, that's different, right?
Right. They're either or. But they're both infections. Epididymis is an infection of, or epididymitis is an infection of the epididymis. And orchitis is an infection of the testicles. And if they have an infection of the testicles, they're going to have epididymitis. It's just depending on how far it's ace ended up.
If they have orchitis, they're going to have epididymitis too?
Yes. Yes. Yes, because the infection they got from sexual transmission. Okay, and so if we back our way back up, you have to go through the epididymis to get to the testicles. So everything beyond that is going to be infected. So it's just one is more severe than the other, which is why I put them in the same spot together. Okay, so when we look at organic causes of erectile dysfunction, which I already covered, but basically if our patients have vascular disease of any type, yeah, you don't have the pictures. Vascular disease of any type, so plaque within their arteries, and remember we've talked about plaque, how we initially have what? We have changes of the endothelium, or the endothelial wall loses its slickness. We begin to put platelets and cholesterol there to attempt to repair. Our immune system responds. Then in addition to that, we might calcify that, which makes our problem worse. And so if our patient has coronary artery disease, carotid artery disease, peripheral artery disease, they're likely to have some degree of erectile dysfunction. We have to ask patients about erectile dysfunction. Now, some patients will willingly tell you. I did hear a cardiologist talk the other day about erectile dysfunction, and he said, you know, you have both extremes. You have the guy that won't bring it up at all, or the guy who just had a heart attack that you're releasing from the hospital 48 hours later that wants to talk about when he can have sex. So you kind of have both extremes, which is not for at least 6 weeks and until you have a stable report is the answer to that. But we do want to ask patients about this because this is a very important part of their health and happiness. This is a patient with early penile cancer, and I wanted to give you a picture of penile cancer. Can we turn off the very front light so people can kind of see? Okay. A lot of the pictures of penile cancer are patients who have developed penile cancer because they had a history of an HPV infection. This particular patient has some lesions here of the penis, and those are not wart-like lesions. Those aren't HPV-type lesions. There are several different types of penile cancers. By no means do you need to really know any of the types of penile cancer. So don't spend any time learning the types of penile cancer at all. Patients need to know if they have any firm growths or changes of the penis, they have any discoloration of the penis, they have a sore on the penis that doesn't heal. There's some patients that were being treated for psoriasis. Some people get psoriasis of the penis just like they can get psoriasis of anywhere else. And we use ultraviolet light or tanning to take care of that. We saw an increased incidence in penile cancer in those patients for a period of time. So it's not a recommended treatment for psoriasis of the penis in that group. This is a kid with a hydrocele that has to hurt.
Oh my Lord.
Does that not make you feel pain? I don't even have a scrotum in it. What? Oh, they're gonna have to drain that. Absolutely.
Well, I didn't know there was like a surgical procedure where they
inserted. I think they'll probably do it very similar. They're gonna probably do it very similar to like peritoneal dialysis. Because it's basically in a hydrocele, basically there's patency here between the peritoneum and the scrotum. There's patency. Is everybody awake now?
It's like to his knees.
They will. Because the patient's going to be at risk for other problems like anal hernia, that type of thing. I think sometimes it happens suddenly.
Wouldn't like somebody notice like that?
At least half that size, I'd be a little bit concerned.
I don't know. Sometimes these things happen more slowly, and sometimes they happen more quickly. So it just depends. Many times the hydrocele, let me tell you a little bit about it. Many times the hydrocele are in infants under the age of one, and so they come up pretty quick. This is probably about, I'd say, a 4 or 5 year old, I would guess. But they happen in really, so they're discovered early, and because they're discovered early, they're remedied early. But maybe this kid maybe had just a little bit of hydrocele, maybe the kid would complain of maybe soreness of the testicles or swelling between their legs, like at the end of the day when they ran around. Then they'd lay down at night, things would kind of neutralize. But eventually, maybe he went and played soccer, and boom, that area that was sort of leaking just, because you have fluid all the time in the peritoneum. So if you open that up and you run around, they could flush it right into there right now. So you don't see this very often because many times it occurred when they're a baby and they're laying down and the parents notice it. But in this particular person's place, I would venture to say there was a little bit of patency. There was a little bit of patency. The child got bigger. The child played a sport like soccer. And that little bit of patency became a lot of patency and it flooded down there just like that. That's what I think. So that would be tough to deal with. Testicular torsion. showing you testicles that have been straightened out here and showing you a testicle that has all twisted up and turned purple. And then I have a real picture here of a little one. This is another one that, although the peak time we see it is in adolescence, and I don't know what the reason for that is, but if there's actually a deformity with the testicles, like one of the reasons that we might see it is that they initially had an undescended testicle. So that testicle's not quite going to be suspended inside of the scrotum as well as the other testicle would be. And so you might see that appear in infancy, and typically there'll be a history that there was an undescended testicle or something of that magnitude. Maybe a preemie baby, something like that.
But so which one's the problem? The swollen one?
This one, the one that's all red. Yes, this one's okay. Okay, testicular cancer, not very common. This is the only other slide you don't have. And the reason that you don't have these slides is this, I wrote another lecture that had all these slides in them, and I don't know where it's at. So I don't know why you don't have it, but now you do. Testicular cancer, 1-2% of all male neoplasms, so not very common. Signs and symptoms, usually starts with a painless nodule that somebody has palpated in the testicle. That's what you hope. Painless, firm nodule. And it peak onset somewhere between 20 and age 35. But we see it in adolescent patients as young as age 13. This is why we want to teach the adolescent patients to do testicular self-examination. We do tons of sports physicals at our office. We start teaching them this with their junior high sports physicals. We start talking to them about examining the testicles. And I don't mean to be biased against males, but I think examining the testicles is probably not a problem for the males. But they need to know if there is a firm, non-tender lesion that they need to report that and let somebody know. And that could be important, you know, that there could be, because at that age, many people aren't thinking that cancer could be something that could cause a problem, you know, or that could occur for me. So we also do see this cancer all the way up to age 60, but that's just it's a very young person cancer. Go ahead.
What is neoplasm?
Cancer.
Okay.
Yeah, neoplasm is a generic tumor for benign or malignant. But it's either benign or malignant, but yeah, neoplasm. Neoplasm means cancerous tumor. Well, you do use neoplasm to describe benign tumors. So other signs and symptoms as it becomes more advanced, whenever there's changes in the testicles, it can cause pain that radiates into the hip. So hip pain, low back pain. Think about, there's always charts that you can look at when you're evaluating patients and talking to patients about their pain that will tell you where pain can be referred to. Never forget when you're doing pain assessments to think about the possibility of referred pain in your patient. Pain in the hip in a patient who's 15, we definitely want to ask them if they've had any changes of their testicles, if they've had any changes of urination, if they had any pain, any soreness, any swelling. We want to ask those questions. Probably it's fine, but if we don't ask those questions and we miss that patient, that's a big mistake, because pretty quickly this can become a malignancy, so we want to catch it very early. Other signs and symptoms, flank pain, changes in urination, tenderness of the scrotum, but those are later. The early sign is going to be that painless nodule of the testicle. And if the patient continues to be worried about something, then we should check it out. So pathophysiology of the female reproductive system, it's divided into different categories. We have age-related problems, hormonal, infectious, and cancers. Age-related problems, some of our age-related problems when we think about reproduction in women is just delayed reproduction altogether. Women are waiting until they're a little bit older to have children because we do other things with our life these days, and that's wonderful. But that does lead to an increase in incidence in things like endometriosis, potentially some scarring of the fallopian tubes. So those types of issues sometimes are things that we have to deal with. As far as educating our patients about delayed reproduction and then future reproductive issues, if our patient's going to wait until they're quite a bit older to have children, first of all, we want to know how old was their mom when their mom went through menopause. Women who are waiting around to have babies need to have these discussions with their mothers. because they need to know, when did my mom go through menopause? Did my mother have trouble with pregnancy? Did my mom have endometriosis? Did my mom have a hysterectomy? Why did my mom have a hysterectomy? I can't tell you the number of women that can't tell me the first thing about their mom's reproductive health, because we just, for some reason, with all the things mothers and daughters talk about, we don't seem to talk about that. Mothers and daughters don't seem to talk about that. I ask women this all the time. They have no idea. They know about their mom's breast cancer, and that's about it. They don't know anything else about their mother's reproduction. So those are important things to know. And then our patients also need to know the importance of controlling their cycle. There's a lot of fear out there, which we talked about last week, about using birth control pills and ability to get pregnant later. If our patient's going to delay in reproduction, we need to control their cycles and reduce their risk of endometriosis, which is going to be one of their greater risks as the years go by without pregnancy. Age-related, and again, menopause problems. Oh my gosh, menopause problems are crazy. Nobody completely understands them. My mom started complaining, and if you ever meet my mom, you cannot repeat this stuff, because she is an operating room nurse up at Carl, so some of you will probably work with her someday. It's so funny, I had some graduates that work with my stepdaughter, Lindsay, in the labor and delivery unit. She said the first thing they said to her was, "Wow, you grew up with Daphne?" She goes, "Yeah," and they were like, "How was that?" It was, whatever, it was fine. My mom's always telling me, yeah, I had some of your students, they've told me some of your stories. So don't be telling my stories. But anyway, my mom started complaining of menopausal type symptoms by the time she turned 30. I mean, just tons of them. She might be a little dramatic. See, that's one you can't tell. That's a secret. Don't post this on the internet. You're going to get me killed. But when she had her hysterectomy years later, she was in her late 40s when she had her hysterectomy. She had to go to genetic counseling because they couldn't see any reason why she couldn't still have children, which she thought was crazy at that point. She'd had children for many years. So the point of that is some women it's short and easy, but most women it's not short and easy, and it's difficult to understand. Some women it starts with patchy cycles. Most women it starts with cycles that become heavier and get closer together. Then sometimes there's a development of what you call uterine fibroids, where they grow these, basically kind of these big moles in the uterus. And then when they have their menstrual cycle, the uterus works the same way. Whether you have a baby or you have your menstrual cycle, it contracts down to stop bleeding. Well, it's trying to contract down over this large mass in your belly. It can't contract down, so the person just keeps bleeding and bleeding and bleeding around these tumors. And so those are just a handful of things that occur. Vasomotor symptoms, hot flashes. That's probably the worst, most intolerable thing that women complain of. They get to where some women can just not stand these, where they in the evening time they begin to happen, and they just happen all evening and all night. And so they're one minute they're in the oven, the next minute they're cold, they're back under the covers, the next minute they're in the oven, then they're cold. Also, bone changes that we see with women as they go through menopause. And unfortunately, women do not have the bone health that they used to. Our diets are not good. Our calcium intake is not really adequate. We drink Coca-Cola and we smoke. And all of those things affect our bone density. So women's bone density is just not as good as it used to be. Hormonal things, metabolic syndrome, polycystic ovary syndrome, diabetes, those things are continuing to rise at a constant rate, and they're all related. All those are related. And don't forget, we talked about this either last week or the week before, but you have the genetic components, you have the lifestyle components, and you have the dietary components. And just depending on your woman, any number of those components can play a bigger role than the other. Endometriosis, again, some hormonal issues with endometriosis because the person isn't cycling perfectly like they should, and so the endometrium in the uterus is beginning to just grow prolifically out of control. And so in endometriosis, the woman has actually begun to grow endometrial tissue in places other than the uterus. So sometimes it's thought that it grows up through the fallopian tubes and sort of out from there. Other times it's thought that maybe it's picked up by local lymph or local vascular tissues, and that allows it to grow somewhere else. I think there's probably a mixture of right answers on that. And your book actually divides that out by type. I don't know that I remember off the top of my head one from the other.
Now that can be either cancerous or non-cancerous.
Yes, depending on, again, how severe the dysplasia and then ultimately the metaplasia becomes, the severity of it, yes, it can become a cancerous thing. especially if it's being picked up by the lymph in the vascular system and moving. Now, if you're growing endometrial tissue around your lungs, we would consider that a cancerous type problem for you. So yes, it certainly can be. Infectious, sexually transmitted infections and HPV being some of the pathophysiology that we see in the reproductive system. HPV being something that we see an awful lot of. Hopefully more and more people are becoming vaccinated for that. We don't want our patients to be afraid of the vaccine. 1 in 4 persons actually has come in contact with HPV in their lifetime. So we really want our patients to do that vaccine and do the full series. Other cancers, breast cancer, prostate, cervical, uterine, just kind of flip through here. And then we kind of can look at it from different disorders, just a different way of looking at the same thing. So let's look at the external genitalia. Bartholin gland cysts, those are where the patient will come in with a painful swelling of the labia. And usually they come in because they really can't walk anymore. They can't wear jeans, they can't sit, they can't walk. And what's done is usually it's opened and drained for the patient. And then just depending on how large it is and how much deformity we think is there, sometimes the whole entire cyst has to be removed by a surgeon. Usually a gynecologist will remove that. Sometimes just opening and draining it one time will take care of it. It just depends. We've had patients that have come in, had it open and drained, never had a trouble again. I've had patients that have had it open and drained, and 3 months later it's back, 3 months later it's back, and eventually they have to have the whole entire cyst removed. Anytime there's a cyst, if it's just opened and drained, there's a chance that the cyst will re-swell and refill with fluid. Disorders of the vulva. There are benign and malignant disorders of the vulva. We have changes in the vulvar tissue and mucosa. That can be from chronic infections, like chronic yeast infections, chronic bacterial infections. There's also a lot of allergies or allergens to the vulva. I tell patients, you know, the tissue on the vulva is very similar to the tissue on your lips. So if you wouldn't stick something on your lips, then you probably shouldn't put it on your vulva. So what does that mean? You know, certain scented things, certain fabric softeners, bleaches, you know, anything that you think could cause a negative reaction on the same tissue that's on your lips, that you probably don't want to put that on the vulva. And especially if your patient's having chronic itching, and if they have chronic itching, they can have changes in the tissue where the tissue is no longer that thin, shiny pink tissue, and it's becoming kind of rough and plaque-like, and we call that lichen sclerosis, and that's because the person is chronically itched there, and the tissue has actually changed because that chronic itching is actually killing off the top tissue over and over and over again, and so the tissue just changes because the cells can't survive with that chronic itching. And then squamous cell hyperplasia, again, some of the same causes here. Malignant things, very rare. Only 3-5% of the actual reproductive female cancers do we see malignancies here of the genitalia. We see squamous cell carcinoma, which is frequently due to HPV. So HPV most commonly is going to cause cancer of the cervix. It can cause cancer of the vagina, and it can cause cancer of the vulva. Malignant melanoma. We are seeing a persistent increase in malignant melanoma of the vulva. Patients need to know if they have a firm lesion or a firm of what they might consider a mole or marking that's especially if it's dark in color at all, they need to have that checked out because melanoma of the vulva is becoming increasingly common. Probably because people are tanning the vulva and they shouldn't probably be tanning it. So, but malignant melanoma, no matter where it's at in the body, malignant melanoma, by the time most people really realize that it's a problem, they're probably dying. That's how malignant melanoma is. It's a very, very important cancer that we really need to have patients be alert that this could be a problem for that. I certainly tell patients who are going to the fake tanning spa to wear their underwear. I think that's a good idea. Add no car, in fact, they should probably not go to the fake tumor this fall. Adenocarcinoma, this is cancer of the mucus cell, similar to the types of cancers that we might see in the colon and the rectum. So again, some of these parts, they kind of parallel each other, they sit near each other. But squamous cell is 90%, and then malignant melanoma, I don't know what percentage it does. And then adenocarcinoma, that patient that would have an adenocarcinoma of the vulva is probably at high risk for colon cancer, because that's the most common type of colon cancer. So here's a picture of Bartholin's cyst. And these are, depending on how swollen they are, they can be so painful. And I've seen them like the size of a tangerine, a small orange. And when they get that big, even if the person who's draining it can't completely take the cyst out, like I can drain them, but I'm not comfortable going in and taking the cyst out. So what we'll do sometimes is we'll pack them and we'll put a drain in them. To sort of suck the fluid out until we can get a surgeon to look at that. This is actually a picture of Bartholin's cyst. Not a very good one. Here's malignant melanoma of the vulva. Actually, it's pretty extensive. This is a labia majora here. Vulva. This person does not have a good prognosis at all. Disorders of the vagina. We can see vaginitis, and so infectious problems, inflammatory problems, age-related problems. Atrophic vaginitis is a really, really common problem that we really need to make sure we're dealing with in our patients who are menopausal or perimenopausal. And don't forget, if our patient had a complete hysterectomy at age 30, they're going to have some of these problems, just like a patient who might be 50-plus might have. The problem with atrophic vaginitis, our patient's going to start having more burning with urination. They might have more urinary tract infections. It gets so severe that it's pretty well impossible for those patients to have intercourse. And generally, that's what prompts them to come in and seek treatment for it. And it's amazing what just a little bit of topical estrogen will do. Be sure that your patients understand that as wonderful as estrogen is for their atrophic vaginitis, that they don't want to use it as a lubricant because it is not good for their partner. Cancers, very rare cancers of the vagina. Most of them are going to be HPV related to squamous cell carcinoma. You can see some malignant melanoma of the vagina, but probably it started in the vulva and moved into there. You can spread through that one. These are some wart-type lesions that sit very close to the skin. There are 160-some lesions that actually end up on the genitalia and potentially can end up on the cervix. We know that lesions number 16 and 18 are the most common to cause cervical cancer, and so all of our vaccines that we provide to patients actually cover lesions 16 and 18 because of the cervical cancer risk. But the reason I use this picture is I think if this person had, you know, plenty of hair growing here, this doesn't really seem that ominous. It doesn't really seem like a whole lot. I have women who will come in for, you know, HPV, maybe cervical changes, maybe external genital warts, and they have partners that just swear up and down, sideways and backwards, that they've never seen a wart in their life. And what you can do if there's questionable tissue that needs to be looked at, or the patient is sure that they don't have warts, but you know we have a situation here between partners, is you can just take a little bit of vinegar on a Q-tip and wipe it on the skin, and the warts will turn white, and the skin will stay a normal color. So it makes the warts just pop right out and stand out. Here's a very, very bad case of the warts. This is actually a vulva that you're looking at here. They're all over the vulva, they're in the vagina. This patient has some sort of immunosuppressive disease like HIV. This is atrophic vaginitis. And as you can see, look how dry this tissue is here. We really can barely even see the labia majora or labia minora anymore. Do you see how all the tissues kind of become sclerosed and yellow? And it just really becomes a problem for these patients, and they scar really easily, and they're very tender, they're very uncomfortable. They have significant shrinkage of the vagina. Okay, disorders of the cervix. So cervicitis, inflammation of the cervix or infection of the cervix. Gonorrhea and chlamydia for both vaginitis and cervicitis being our main problem. Cervical lesions, we have premalignant lesions. The majority of patients today we are evaluating and we are treating at the point of premalignant lesions. Because not every person who comes in contact with HPV, not every person who has an abnormal pap smear is actually going to develop a cancer. We just don't always know which one is which. And so we tend to treat all the patients the same way and try to halt this very early. Did you know in the 1950s that cervical cancer was the leading cause of cancer-related death in women at that time? So it's not become a bigger problem. We just didn't totally know what it was and how it worked at that time. And in developing countries, cervical cancer is still a major cause of death. I thought that was really interesting. When I read that, I was kind of shocked because I didn't know that. For other pre-malignant lesions that you could see that maybe would not be related to HPV, it's just somebody who maybe has a chronic bacterial infection that causes then tissue changes of the cervix. But those are very, very rare. I would say less than 1% of your patients with cervical lesion actually have a chronic bacterial infection. Everyone else has an HPV, probably number 16 or number 18 HPV lesion. So if we look at a normal cervixes, they kind of look like pencil erasers. I've looked at a lot of them over the years. When we're looking with a speculum, we sort of go into the vagina, we open up the speculum, and the cervix will actually pop right into the speculum. So it actually stands out as an organ on its own. We have a primiferous and a multiferous cervix. Multiferous cervix just basically means the cervix hasn't been dilated in the past, and so there's more of a pinpoint hole there. Once the cervix has been dilated, there's kind of permanently a slit that occurs there. And then we see cervicitis. This is where we see some discolored mucus coming from the cervix, but also do you see a difference in the way the cervix itself looks here? It's more red, it's more swollen. It just doesn't look, this is a nice light pink. The cervix is the same pinkness as the vaginal wall. And here, of course, the vaginal wall is a little more pink too, but there's going to be an increased pinkness. Frequently, patients with cervicitis have cervical motion tenderness. When I worked at Eastern, we called it CMT and not the music station. But cervical motion tenderness, either when we go in there and we look with the speculum, or if we take our fingers and we just move their cervix, it causes pain, usually that shoots through to their back, sometimes through their abdomen, but usually through to the mid-back. And that's a sign that your patient has an infection that is in the cervix and potentially has pelvic inflammatory disease. We tend to tell the patient at the point that we move their cervix and it causes pain that goes through their back, that they have an infection of the pelvis, and we tend to treat it that way because we don't want to take a chance that you know, we just treat the cervix itself. Okay, so here's some real cervixes. This cervix is a normal cervix. Most of the time there's clear mucus, clear to sort of milky colored mucus on the cervix. The mucus really doesn't have an odor. There's no discomfort. And the cervix is typically the same tissue color as the vaginal walls. This is a patient who has mucopious cervicitis. Probably has gonorrhea, maybe gonorrhea and chlamydia, both. Chlamydia is kind of a funny thing because chlamydia can kind of be there and the person can have no symptoms and just boom, one day find out that they have it. Frequently, actually, I would say males have more symptoms of chlamydia than females do. They might actually present with burning with urination and get diagnosed, and we diagnose it in our females. In females, the Center for Disease Control recommends that all females between the age of 15 and 25 are screened annually for chlamydia, so we pick it up in annual routine screening. Now, gonorrhea, on the other hand, it has significant discharge that drips and moves out of the cervix. And so you can really see a lot of mucus and a lot of discharge from the gonorrhea. So it is more apparent when it's there. Gonorrhea is a little harder to diagnose. We now have DNA probes for both gonorrhea and chlamydia, which is good because before, when we did not have the DNA probes that can find the DNA of the bacteria, we had to culture the gonorrhea, and gonorrhea is an anaerobe. And so what does that mean when you culture an anaerobe? No oxygen. So you'd have to hurry up and put it on the chocolate auger, shut the chocolate auger, turn it upside down, put it in a container, and light a candle to take all the air out of the container and grow it that way. And so you can see in that process how there would be pretty good margin for error, and so you might not always pick that up. That's why when we tell our patients that they have pelvic inflammatory disease, and maybe we just have a positive chlamydia and we have a negative gonorrhea, part of the pelvic inflammatory disease treatment protocol is going to cover both of those, because we know there's some error in being able to detect them. We can now detect both gonorrhea and chlamydia in male patients in urine, and I don't think it's reliable, is as reliable in females, but we can use the urine test in males and in females. But it certainly helps with getting males to come in and actually have an STD check, is for them to be able to urinate in a cup versus getting the stick. Cervical lesions, pathogenesis. Now, we have about 160 that can infect the whole urogenital area, but only about 40 types actually infect the cervix. And very commonly, when a female patient comes in and has warts all over the external genitalia, you're going to find a parallel with that. You're going to often find that they really don't have any problems with the cervix. Typically, the HPV that infects the vulva does not tend to infect the cervix or the vagina. And so oftentimes, you don't see the two conditions together. So you have people that have external warts, you have people that have cervical condyloma, and rarely do you have it in both places at the same time, because wherever you have the condyloma, you have some general immunity then to condyloma because it's there. So it's rare that you actually see it in both cases. If we see it, if we see condyloma throughout all of the genitalia, then we do need to be concerned that maybe the patient has some immunodeficiency virus. 15 strains are high risk, but number 16 and number 18 make up 70% of the cervical lesions that cause cervical cancer in our patients. And these are young women. When we initially have an abnormal pap smear below the age of 18, and then we follow that up and it's positive for HPV, their risk of having consequences related to HPV are higher than someone who is over the age of 18. Did anybody ever figure out what that situation was that they talked to me about not doing pap smears before age 18? Was that just a funding issue? What? No. I know that no one was lying.
Oh.
I was asking, did you find out about the funding or what the situation was?
Well, I worked with this doctor on Lincoln, and he was actually talking about it, that they only, whatever he was saying was with the insurance, that they were only paid for it in a way.
So it's a funding issue.
Yeah.
Who do you work for?
Howsworth.
Oh, Dr. Howsworth. Okay. But he doesn't necessarily think it's because they don't need to be done.
He thinks they need to be done.
Yeah, they need to be done. Okay. That's what I thought. It's a funding issue. Dr. Howsworth actually did a lot of colposcopies and a lot of procedures for me when I worked at Eastern. Okay. So, again, and, you know, the other thing is, you know, insurance companies, just a fast side note, they get smart. You know, if government agencies are going to fund, you know, pap smears and STD screening and that type of thing, why should they do that? Same thing, we deal with the same thing with vaccines. We have multiple insurance companies that will not pay for vaccines at all because they know if a person signs a form that says my insurance will not pay for vaccines, that the government provides the vaccines for free. So it sort of gives incentives to the insurance companies not to actually cover those things, and I think that's probably what we're seeing is corner cutting by the insurance companies, which is a whole other issue. Let's go back to this. Number 6 and 11 are the most common cause of genital condyloma. And, you know, although genital condyloma of the vulva or the vagina, that may not cause cancer in our patients, but it certainly causes discomfort. It's certainly difficult to treat. It's certainly something that the patient doesn't want to look at. And it can also cause urinary problems because those condyloma can actually end up in the opening of the urethra. And so our patients can end up with some urinary retention from that. The growth starts in the transformation zone. And if you remember back there to the picture of the cervix, the transformation zone is inside this little hole here. So when we do a pap smear, we have this thing that I call the spatula. And we go all the way around the outside of the cervix with that. And just basically, we're wiping away the tissue that might fall off. And then we have a little brush, and the brush goes into that little hole, and we turn that. And that's where the transformation zone is. And so in young patients, when they get their pap smear back, we want to check it. And a lot of times the nurses are the ones that are checking this. We want to check that and make sure that there's a transformation zone on there. Because if our patients are going to have an issue with their cervix, it's going to start in their transformation zone. So that's a very important part of the pap smear. Why does it start here? Well, these are the newest, least mature cells. And then infections and chronic changes in the hormones lead to progression. Let's take a look at this cervix here. This is a normal cervix. This is a cervix that has some low-grade lesion, which you can see with the light. And we have lights when we do pap smears that shine on here. You can see just a little bit of change here. And then we have more defined change here, followed by, in this particular patient who has cervical cancer, we definitely have a mass here growing on this cervix. And when we feel the cervix, one of the reasons that we do bimanual exams besides checking the ovary, when we feel the cervix, when a patient has a cervical cancer lesion, cancer is always pretty hard. It's pretty firm. So you're going to feel the cervix has its own firmness, but then the cancerous lesion may feel kind of bone-like. It's very, very hard, very firm. And so the patient, what might the patient complain of if they don't know they have cervical cancer? Well, they might complain of dysfunctional intrauterine bleeding. Well, they're bleeding when they shouldn't be. Bleeding after intercourse, pain with intercourse. Those are all indicators that our patient could have a cervical lesion. This is a cervix, which is, look, these are those very early lesions I showed you here. And this is a completely cancerous cervix. And you can see there's a whole, and this is a whole tumor here at this point. So seeing the difference. And so this would be very firm and hard. This red here is necrosis from the tumor that you're seeing. Whereas here where it started, they probably used just a little bit of vinegar and wiped down the cervix, and they could turn those lesions white and see there. And see how they're kind of coming out of that transformational area there. That's where it starts and kind of grows outward. And this is a very, very severe lesion of the cervix. It's actually extended into the vagina. I would say this person had, I don't think this is in a living person at this point. I think this was probably all surgical. So prevention of cervical cancer, Gardasil recommended for 9 to 26-year-old patients, for males and for females. In males, the HPV number 16 and 18 can cause rectal cancer and cancer of the sigmoid colon. So that's one thing to keep in mind with our male patients. And the other thing is that the male patients also have the same risk with number 6 and number 11 of getting the condyloma into the urethra inside the penis. And if when in the male patients we see that condyloma getting into the urethra, that almost always ends up in a surgical situation where they end up with a catheter for a period of time. So it really becomes a traumatic thing. They have 3 vaccines over a 6-month period. We haven't studied the older populations or populations that have a history of past exposure to HPV. Because what we're doing is we're trying to cause some immune response to HPV, and we're sort of reintroducing a denatured purified protein to the patient, there's some worry that if the person had HPV in the past, and maybe they've not completely cleared that, there's still some fragments of the virus in their body, there's some worry that when we give the vaccine, that it actually might cause the HPV to reoccur in those patients. So, at some point, I think they'll probably find that it doesn't, and we'll probably see this given kind of across the board over time. But right now, they're really saying if the patient has a history of documented HPV, we don't want to give it. Pap smears. How often should pap smears be done? Well, the liquid pap smears, which is what everybody uses now, should be done every 2 years. And as long as the pap smears have been normal, it's actually not recommended that the patients have their pap smear more often than every 2 years. Because it's thought that we actually find things that might have just cleared up on their own. Most cervical cancer cases, it took 8 years from the early lesion to the cervical tumor. So we feel like we're in a comfortable window of time doing them every 2 years. And because as long as the transformational zone is there, the pap smears are now so much more accurate than what they used to be. The procedures are better. In lower risk patients, every 3 years. So our patients maybe who are in a long-term monogamous relationship, They maybe they're not planning any additional pregnancies. They have no symptoms. They come in for an annual woman's check anyway because they need to have a breast exam and they need to have an ovary exam anyhow. So those patients we can move to every 3 years. Patients who have had a complete hysterectomy that continue to be in a monogamous relationship, they really don't, I mean, it's kind of controversial, but they really don't have a big need for ever having a pap smear again. If they're not in a completely monogamous relationship or they've changed relationships, remember some of the same things that can cause cancer of the cervix can cause cancer of the vagina, and so maybe a once every 3 years is not a bad idea, and so we just do a vaginal swab. Looking at cervical cancer per 100,000, I just want to point out to you here, you don't have to read this slide, but the dark blue are the worst states in the United States. This is where we live. So if you think that we're safe here, you're thinking wrong. You have been incorrectly told. And you know, if you consider the fact that when we think about healthcare changes, like if you ever take an epidemiology class or you learn a little bit more about epidemiology, most epidemiology starts in the coastal states, usually on the East Coast, and then it just kind of just skips right over, because I think the coastal people like the coast, so they go from here to here, and from here to here. And so we usually start on the East Coast, then we see it on the West Coast, then we see it in the Midwest. And so it's interesting to me that Illinois is so high and so prevalent. No, something to think about. There's not very many dark blue states, like maybe Florida and Georgia. And we know, you know, all of our older populations that are new people in retirement is part of those numbers. So I don't know. You know, they must do a better job at educating people over here. I mean, like, what's the deal here with Oregon? They're in good shape. Okay, premalignant lesions. So what is the readings that we see on the pap smear mean? Ask us, is atypical squamous cell of undetermined significance? So this is what we call a grade 2 pap smear. It's not quite normal, but we're not sure that it's very important. So in these patients, they're going to be instructed to report any new signs and symptoms, pain with intercourse, discharge, vaginal odor, itching, pain in their back, dysfunctional uterine bleeding. But they're probably just going to be left alone, and we're going to recheck them in 6 months. Now, if they're a high-risk patient and they have lots of signs and symptoms, we might actually test that patient then for HPV. But if they're not a high-risk patient or they don't have lots of signs and symptoms, we just kind of sit on it. LSIL, this is a low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion. And most of these, we know from experience, are going to go away on their own. So we will probably test the patient for HPV. And if they show up positive for high-risk HPV, then they probably will take a closer look with colposcopy at their cervix. If they don't show up positive for high-risk HPV, we kind of do the same thing. We just sit on it for 6 months or so, and we repeat it again. And then our high-grade, our squamous cell intraepithelial lesion, these patients we already know because it's high-grade that they must have HPV. And so they go immediately for colposcopy and LEAP procedures and that type of thing to treat that. Cryosurgery. We know when we see HSIL that basically there's a high-grade change here. There's high-grade dysplasia of the cervical cells that they can see in the pap smear. And so we know this whole cell cycle is completely disrupted in these patients. And gradually it's going to progress to cancer. And sometimes it can remain static. So patients can be found with an HSIL lesion that's just been sitting there for a long time. So there's really a big window of time. There's no reason that anybody is dying from this. There's really no reason that there's major issues from this. We should be taking care of this more quickly than we are. I did have a patient that died of cervical cancer when I worked in the hospital, and she wasn't very old. She was younger than me. I think she was maybe 36, and it was a long time ago. And she died. She bled to death while we were trying to clean her up so her kids could come in and see her. And then at that time, I didn't really know anything about cervical cancer. And then over the years, as I've learned about cervical cancer, it seems so unfortunate. She went in to see her gynecologist, and she hadn't seen her youngest one was maybe 6 or 7. He was little. I remember he was little because he was out in the hall. It was very sad. But she had not been back to the gynecologist since that baby was born. And she had started having increased cramping and bleeding and pain with intercourse. And when she went in to see the gynecologist, the tumor was already there and her blood counts were already low. She'd lost a significant amount of blood. And so she ended up in the hospital, then ended up in the ICU. It wasn't a surgical situation. I think they tried to radiate it, which made the bleeding worse, and she died. Yes?
For the LSIM, will you do the one HPV risk for the colposcopy? And then you sit on it for 6 months. If it's still there, like some
dysplasia,
is that when you do like the cryotherapy?
Colposcopy is part of the cryotherapy. Okay. The way we test for HPV is we just send an order into the lab and they take the liquid sample that we did the pap smear from and they test for HPV DNA in that sample. So it's a DNA test that's taken out of the pap sample. Okay. So it's very, very easy to do. It's non-invasive to the patient at all. So if they have the LSIL, they haven't had that in the past, we have the pap smear actually checked for the HPV DNA. So we do a DNA probe on the pap smear. And if that's positive, then they're sent on to a specialist and they'll do a colposcopy. And just depending on what they find, depends on how they treat it. So it just depends on what they find. A LEAP procedure is very extensive. In a LEAP procedure, they're gonna take off the outer portion of the cervix, but they're also going to go in and electrically take out the part of the transformation zone. So that's actually going into the transformation zone, removing tissue there, and removing it. On colposcopy, a lot of times, they're just kind of barely getting into the transformation zone, and they'll either use laser or electric cauterization or cryotherapy to take off the areas that they think are affected. And you don't have to know all that. It's just an FYI. And again, this is the only other thing I thought was kind of interesting is the book talks about that there is a camera device that they can use to actually look into the cervix that's less invasive and less painful for our patients than colposcopy. Your book talks about that. You can look at it. But it's just an option for the patient who's absolutely terrified of going in and having a LEAP or colposcopy. There's some other ways that they can deal with that. Because some colposcopies end up in no treatment at all, but the patient has a lot of pain with the colposcopy. So there are some other ways that they can do it. Early diseases of the cervix, I talked about this, vaginal bleeding, spotting. The patient might complain of discharge. They might have kind of chronic cervical infections like bacterial vaginosis, yeast. It's not that those things cause it, but those things are a symptom that things aren't quite right there. Dysfunctional cyclic bleeding, especially if there's a lesion at all, because if it's bumped or hit or touched, that lesion's going to bleed. The cervix is friable as it is. Friable means it can bleed. The cervix is already friable, so if we have an abnormal lesion on the cervix, it becomes very friable. Leg disease, we see back pain, pelvic pain, it can radiate down the leg. We see some blood sometimes in the urination. Sometimes there's actually been some metastasis into the bladder or into some of the urinary structures. Lymphadenopathy, inguinal. And as it begins to spread through the body, we can see some supraclavicular lymphadenopathy in patients that have full blown malignancy. It does definitely move in the lymph nodes. Treatment, we kind of talked about this. Cervicitis, we've talked a little bit about this as we went through the lecture today, and you can look at it. Remembering gonorrhea and chlamydia being our most common sexually transmitted types of cervicitis. We also have trichomoniasis, which is a protozoa infection. Remember we learned about that when we did the Helminth lecture. Non-sexually transmitted, candidiasis and Gardnerella. Gardnerella is also a protozoa, but we call it bacterial vaginosis. But it really technically is a protozoa that we're dealing with. But these aren't really sexually transmitted. But again, like I said earlier, patients who are repeatedly getting infected with these infections is probably a symptom that things aren't quite right with our patient. So we need to go back and we look at the cervix. We need to look at what's happening here. Also, remembering, too, if our patient's getting chronic non-sexually transmitted vaginal infections, don't forget about the vulva. Remember I said, you know, we don't want to put certain things on the vulva. If a person has allergies, if a person has sensitive skin, we want to be careful about what comes in contact with the vulva. So we start looking at what soap are you using, how much bleach are you using, in your underclothing are you using perfumes, scented lotions, any of those types of things, those could be contributing to these non-sexually transmitted infections that we're seeing in the cervix. You guys are so tired today, aren't you? I see heads bobbing everywhere. You just gotta perk up a little bit more. We have to keep going. Disorders of the uterus, endometritis. This is an infection of the endometrium. This frequently has ascended from the cervix. So this is our GC, chlamydia, sometimes other atypical infections that have ascended from the cervix and ended up in there. And the best way to treat that is they will dilate and curettage that. They'll actually just remove that endometrium, and that takes out the disease tissue, and that takes out the necrotic tissue, and they start over again.
That's your DNC.
Mm-hmm. Adenomyosis. This is problems with the endometrial tissues and glands that are within the uterine and smooth muscles. Most common in the fourth, fifth decade of life. So this is a problem that occurs with those perimenopausal women. The patients are going to have heavy, painful menses, clots, pain with intercourse. And when they biopsy the endometrium, they'll have endometrial hyperplasia. So that's what tells us that that's what's causing their problem versus something else, is that biopsy of the endometrium. And what do? We treat with oral contraceptives, or if they're not a candidate for oral contraceptives or it's severe, we just take the uterus out and do a hysterectomy. Did you have a question? No, just moved your arm?
Yeah.
Okay, fibroid tumors. Benign neoplasms of the uterine smooth muscle. They're like big moles that grow into the uterine wall, benign moles. And the more of them that grow, the more dysfunction there becomes with the ability of the uterus to contract down. And part of the reason that we use the uterus for the things that we use it for is that it can contract down and it can stop bleeding. And so because those fibroids are in there, the uterus is trying to contract down over them, it can't, and that causes increased bleeding and some clotting. You will see patients that actually have both of these conditions at the same time. They're usually perimenopausal patients. And they may come in white as a ghost with a hemoglobin of 5. I mean, they come in and they're pretty sick and their blood counts are pretty off. They can regress after menopause. So once the person has went through menopause and the estrogen stimulation there is gone, they can go away. It's just whether or not your patient is able to handle the bleeding and the clotting and the side effects of them. And they can either take them out or they can do a hysterectomy. And this kind of shows you where we can see some different fibroids. And some of our worst ones are the ones that are actually growing here in the uterine cavity, but they get into the muscular wall, and it can really have some effects on the ability to contract down. We can also see them sort of grow out of the uterine wall as well, or on the other side. This is a big fibroid right here. Yeah. The uterus, after a pregnancy, the uterus is probably about the size of a pea. And this is a fibroid, not a uterus. Yes?
My cousin had a situation where she had a fibroid, actually the dad, and she had it removed in like January. And she was like experiencing pregnancy symptoms. Like, I don't know if that's like, if that has anything to do with it, I was going to ask you.
Well, I'm pretty sure if your cousin was young and she had something that size in her uterus, she probably did think she was pregnant.
Like, she would tell us she was pregnant every month, and we just like laugh at her. And
eventually,
it was a tumor, and we just was like, wow.
You were pregnant with something. You know, it's funny, because this one time, I had this lady come in, and she had come in with digestive type troubles, like kind of the feeling like maybe that constipation was kind of causing her to have some abdominal pain, like she had this full feeling, and she was kind of constipated. And you know, since then, you know, we've learned, you know, problems with the ovaries can cause that as well. But anyway, you know, I checked her out. We sent her for colonoscopy, what have you. she comes back maybe 6 months later, and basically it's kind of been going on all this time. It's really not gotten better. She's not seen any improvement. And so, you know, I'm listening to her heart and lungs. I lay her back on the table, and I push down and I feel, and I could feel a hard mass through her belly. I mean, I could feel a firm mass that went all the way to the umbilicus. And that was the point at which I said, well, you're either having a baby or you have a tumor in your belly. I mean, it was that apparent that she had the tumor. And she was a little bit shocked because she had maybe gotten used to the tumor being there. And she ended up having five fibroids, but one of them was about basketball sized. And her complaints were all digestive. And when she first came in, I did not feel the fibroids. So that's how much the fibroid had grown in that period of time. She had pain with intercourse and dysfunctional intrauterine bleeding and some digestive effects. So a big problem. And this is not something that a woman can wait out. Not this particular tumor here. It's not going to work out. This is showing the whole group of fibroids. There's one. Pelvic inflammatory disease. In pelvic inflammatory disease, generally the precursor to pelvic inflammatory disease is either a gonorrhea or a chlamydia infection, or that our patient has an infection with HPV, and that's kind of destabilized their normal flora. And so ultimately, they end up with these infections of the pelvis. So an infection of the pelvis is an infection that gets into the uterus. It can be in the fallopian tubes, and it can actually go all the way up to the ovaries. And the more severe the infection, the more symptoms that the patient has. The patient very commonly has cervical motion tenderness. They have tenderness across the abdomen that radiates into the back. They frequently have a fever. They have diarrhea. They kind of have mild sepsis-type symptoms. So not like a severe sepsis, but definitely they're sick. They're sick patients. They don't feel good. Risk factors, untreated sexually transmitted infections, are patients who have multiple sex partners, patients who have a history of HPV infection. Right after the menses, the cervix is more dilated, so the likelihood that an infection of the cervix could crawl up into the pelvis increases. And so that's why if you look at the timing of it, if they just had their menses, you know, last week and now this week they're having lots of pain and cramping and fever and what have you, that's a big indicator, that's a big sign that you're probably looking at a pelvic inflammatory disease. What do we do to treat it? We use several different antibiotics for it. So we use multiple antibiotics because we're dealing with multiple different bacterias and infections in our patients. Our patients need to understand with each time that they would get an infection of the pelvis that their risk of scarring the fallopian tubes goes up. There's about a 20% risk that the fallopian tubes will be scarred after the first incident, and it goes up by 20 to 40% with each additional incident. And basically, a female with three or more incidents of pelvic inflammatory disease, we have some concern that there will not be pregnancy in that female because the fallopian tubes, I used to tell my patients, are about the size of a toothpick. That's about the width of the inside of the fallopian tube. So there's not a lot of room for scars in there. So they do scar up. And it's hard, they do procedures where they open up the fallopian tubes, but those aren't terribly successful procedures. This is showing a fallopian tube that's full of scar tissue. Here's our corpus luteum. Here's our sperm, obviously they can't get there. The other thing is over time, patients who have scarring of the fallopian tubes, they have ovarian pain. They have pain when they ovulate, they have pain when they develop follicles, because the ovaries don't have any passageway. That fallopian tube is no longer open, and so there ends up being some inflammation and some ovarian issues that occur in these patients. This is a patient who had chronic pelvic inflammatory disease, and this is the uterus. And you can see here, let's see if I can find it for you. There's a fallopian tube. There's a fallopian tube, but this is very distorted. This is not normal looking tissue at all. Lots of inflammation there. Very not normal looking. I would assume this patient is unconscious anymore. This is showing you, this is a tubal pregnancy that's occurred in a patient who has scarred fallopian tubes. So you can see basically the pregnancy started but has progressed too far and it can't get out of that fallopian tube. So they have to take out the pregnancy and take out the tube. You do, you know, patients every now and then do have a successful pregnancy outside of uterus, but it's not something they recommend at all. Because the risk of bleeding to death is the issue.
But I would love the baby in the mouth.
You guys can look at endometriosis. These are those theories I told you about how it spreads. That's clearly outlined in chapter 39 of your book. Showing you with endometriosis, this patient, this was a case study I put in here. This patient has some sort of striated, it's very abnormal looking tissue that we see here. And this shows you, this is the outside of the uterus. You can see the striated tissue out around here that the endometriosis is occurring. You can just read that case study. You can look at cystocele, rectocele, uterine prolapse. Those are all covered in your reading. Disorders of the ovary, cystic lesions that we see with polycystic ovary syndrome. What's happening in our polycystic ovary syndrome patients is that they aren't having the normal fluctuations in estrogen and progesterone, and then ultimately they are not having the spikes in FSH and LSH that they should have. So that every month, a normal person develops up to 14 follicles in their ovary, but only one ends up becoming a corpus luteum. So they're developing these follicles, and they're developing these near corpus luteums, but the hormones just never reach a point that they release the corpus luteum. So then because that one didn't get released, that continues to cause a further hormone imbalance. And so then the next month, they make another corpus luteum, and that one doesn't get released, and then we have a further hormone imbalance. And as a result, we end up with these very large cystic ovaries. After the ovaries get to a certain size, one of the things we worry is that they might rupture. That would be one of our worries for our patients. Frequently in patients that have this problem, they're pre-diabetic patients. They have what we call polycystic ovary syndrome, or they have metabolic syndrome. And again, the same thing that we've talked about with type 2 diabetes, I've said it several times, there's those three components. There's the lifestyle, the diet, and the genetics. Depending on the female that you're looking at, depends on which one's playing the bigger role with them. Ovarian tumors, we do see some ovarian cancers. Some of our same patients who are at risk for estrogen-based breast cancer are also at risk for ovarian cancer. The problem with ovarian cancer is that the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer are kind of insidious. They're not very apparent or obvious. So they might have a little bit of urinary change because there might be a tumor kind of laying on their bladder. They might have some bowel changes, nausea, kind of pregnancy type symptoms the patient might complain of. That certainly is something we want to look at the ovary. And just looking at our polycystic ovary versus our normal ovary. See, in a normal ovary, you can see there's several little follicular cysts here. But in a polycystic ovary, there's these overdeveloped near corpus luteum cysts. And so this ovary is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So I hear lots of patients told that they have an ovarian cyst when they go in with like side pain or whatever, and then they come in and they're worried about polycystic ovary syndrome. But if it just says your patient has, you know, 7 to 14 follicular cysts, your patient doesn't really have a polycystic ovary problem. Your patient just has the follicular cyst that they develop. So it's a patient with enlarged ovaries with overly developed follicles. So they don't call those follicular cysts. They call those precorpus luteums, or they call those complex cysts of the ovary. And you can take a look at this. This talks a little bit about ovarian cancer. This is showing you an ovarian carcinoma versus a normal ovary. This is a picture of an ovarian carcinoma, which is not very clear. All right, that's it.